Welcome to Automates, the podcast that brings you musings from thought leaders and industry pioneers who are shaping the way we work, think, and succeed. Each episode is packed with insights, expert interviews, and practical tips that will inspire and empower you to take your business to the next level. So tune in, subscribe, and get ready to innovate with Automates.
Good afternoon, Jana Blount. How are you? You well?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Thank you very much for coming on board on this Friday afternoon. This is my last meeting of the week, so it's a good one that I'm sharing it with you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
But it's not really a meeting. It's not really a meeting, but you know, there's no pressure. It's just a friendly one. So I have known you through many guises. I first met you whilst you were at DLA. For the audience, why don't you just give us a quick rundown of where you are now, what you're doing, and then we can dig into some content and information.
Yeah, sure. So I was at DLA. As you said, that's where you met me. And I was there for about 8 years where I was the change maker, leading up the radical change, strategy, innovation, team capabilities, products, and services that came out of there. I have left DLA about a year and a half now, and I'm working as a legal innovation consultant. I work with both in-house teams and law firms to think about what change strategies they should be undertaking, what transformation would make the most sense, and then, of course, how they actually do that change and transformation. So change strategy or capability creation, that's kind of my sweet spot.
Cool. So so we're going to dig into capability creation a little bit later, because I think that's a really, not many people are talking about that kind of stuff, particularly within legal, but I think they are, but they might not be calling it that, but it'd be good to dig into that. I love the fact that your job title was change maker. How long did it take for you guys to come up with the title change maker?
I joke, but it's actually true. That took the longest thing of all. So when I was initially having conversations with Simon about, you know, radical change, was I interested, which was an immediate, absolutely, right? And then he was like, all right, let's work on the job description. Let's define radical. And then I guess we had to think of your title. So everything else was kind of all in line. And then it was an extra bit of time to land on change.
It's one of those things that is sort of, you either go conventional or you do something that is radical. You do sort of try and like make people think, okay, why, what? Well, I presume that's why, reading between the lines, that's why I think sort of you ended up where you ended up, which is really interesting for a large corporate kind of environment to be thinking in that way.
Absolutely.
Was that influenced by Simon and his vision and what he was doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So he was starting his second term as a global co-CEO and was, you know, looking around at the industry, looking around at the legacy he wanted to leave. And that was, you know, there was a lot of people talking about innovation, right? And we felt very strongly at the time that innovation, and people might say it still has, kind of lost its meaning or sense. Like everyone was kind of throwing that word around, but what did that mean and what was really happening from it? And what we did see a lot of was, and this is great and it should happen, a lot of improving what already existed. How might our lawyers do things quicker, more efficiently, more effectively, which everyone should be thinking about. But radical change was in the space of what else? How could we really do something that was different? How could we create new products, new services, and new client experiences? And so that was, and you hit the nail on the head when you said the reason we went with the change maker was it was a signal to the industry, to our competitors, but it was also as much of a signal internally as well, right? I wasn't within the normal naming hierarchy of DLA either. So it was awesome in the sense that it just gave me a lot of latitude to be disruptive, to be challenging, to say, actually, no, like this is what this should look like. This is what radical is. This is not, we're not fitting within the things that already exist.
I think that, I mean, sort of, I think you touched on something there around like innovation and the concept of innovation sort of 7-8 years ago was like, we're sort of striving forward, we're doing different things. really, innovation was not really innovation. It's going to sound controversial, but it wasn't. It was iterative changes. It was, how do we be 10% better? It wasn't, how do we rethink what we're doing in this particular practice area or this thing to drive new revenue streams or whatever it might be. I think you're sort of right in the sense that the idea of innovation has almost become BAU. It was a fancy thing and still is fancy, but it's sort of now, it's expected. You're expected to be innovative. You're expected. So it's less of a badge. It's less of a thing. It's and I think there's a couple of firms who I think still do the innovation thing well because they've got R&D environments completely carved out from other teams that are thinking about new technologies, new ways of doing things and thinking about new sort of business offerings and stuff like that. But they are carved out. They are separate. And I think that's where innovation can come from, if that makes sense, as opposed to the BAU of the world and everything else. I don't know what your thoughts about that sort of stuff are. But
yeah. I have a lot of thoughts on that. I think I gave a feature. Yeah. Just let me go through all. And I think, again, it's like, what do we mean when we say innovation? But innovation should be BAU, right? I mean, there's not a company in existence in legal or any industry that can be complacent and say, the way that we're doing things now is the way we'll be doing things in 5 years. That's just not true, right? So thinking about how you do things differently, better across the board in every bit of your business, in how you do your finances and how you do your client intake and how you do CR, everything really should be thinking about, how might we do this better? How could we leverage new technologies and all of that? So in that sense, absolutely, innovation should not be its own standalone kind of silo that is a separate strategy detached from this overall strategy of the business and what they want to achieve. Then I think if you're talking about, well, how do we create the new? How do we create the more, I guess, if we're going to use this word, disruptive things, then yeah, I believe it. They need their own space because, you know, as a business, you need to keep going, keep being profitable, keep making your money, keep doing better within your core offerings. And then you do need people that are dedicated to thinking, and next, and what else, and how might we, and what if we didn't do any of that again, or what if something really radical, as we're seeing in the world already, comes in and just disrupts everything, what would we do then, and what would that new offering be for our clients?
No, so I think it's one of those things that sort of, it takes it's a stake in the ground. When you guys did it, Simon, and you guys sort of took that step, there were lots of firms doing stuff, but we typically operate in an industry and like law firms who don't like change. They don't like disruption. They like the 6 minute model. It's just the way that it's always been. And I think occasionally you need to make those steps back to truly think about what innovation means, what change means, what that sort of looks like. So I guess that must have been really exciting at that point in time. Sort of, I don't know, how many years did you do that role at DLA before you moved on?
Around four.
So I mean, I think that's the sort of thing that sort of, I can see why you jumped at the chance to sort of do that.
It was amazing. Dream job. Yeah, it was. And I think that's what I'm trying to carry on now and what I do, you know, the capability creation, the new strategy, that space, because that's what's really exciting to me, right? When it's really ambiguous and literally a blank piece of paper, right? Yeah. That's so exciting. Yeah, what definitely. Could you do with that? What might this be? How could we? What would this look like? Who do you bring in to do that? What would our clients really want? Asking those questions and then doing all the research and having those client conversations, using your design thinking methodology and you know, strategy sessions to figure all that out. That's, I love that.
Yeah,
so yeah, it is really exciting.
And so talk to me about sort of the design thinking side of things as we move around. I hear words and I go, like, oh, let's talk about that. But the design thinking piece is 5-6 years ago, there were quite a lot of firms talking about it. Mm. I don't know. Design thinking for me personally means lots of different things. You get it within the view of a contract. So you're quite thinking about what does the contract need to look like and how, because what's the constructs of it and how can we present it better to make an idiot like me understand what the contracts mean, all the way through to practice sort of vision and what does that organizational structure need to be? What are the resources that we need? Where do those resources need to be? So I think in my head, design thinking is just a whole bunch of ideas and models and thoughts and processes, yeah. I guess, to then try and start to solve problems. Again, it means lots of things to different people. For you guys, how important was it to have sort of a foundational view of this is what it is and this is why it's important to radical change and what we're doing within the firm? And did you have to take, you mentioned sort of the balance between sort of being called a change maker and the impact it has on your customers and or your clients and your sort of the market itself. But the internal side of things, how did that help sort of drive some of those ideas internally in terms of building out that sort of body of knowledge and sort of using it as a function?
Yeah. So design thinking, I learned about it, I don't know when I learned about it, a while ago, a long time ago. And for me, what resonated strongly with the process was that it was a process that kind of encapsulated the way my brain worked. If I can make it, if that's yep. the best way I can describe it, right? And what do I mean by that? Design thinking in and of itself, if we break it down to its simplest form, is three steps, right? Empathy. So you're really taking the time to figure out what your clients, users, potential clients really need or would love, right? And so you're going deeper, asking why a lot. Everyone says that, but thinking about how you really figure out those unvoiced and unmet needs. And that's a yeah. different way of talking to clients than you're used to as a lawyer or in a law firm, or even in business in general, I think. And then the second part is that ideation piece where you go wild, you go crazy, you do, you know, all sorts of ideation with the post-its and everything. And then the third part is what we're calling prototyping. So you're doing some more experimentation. You're doing safe, cheap ways of testing some assumptions before you go and launch a massive multi-million pound project. So when Simon first asked me about being the change maker, creating the change council, helping define what we meant by radical, the first thing I said was we're not going to be able to do anything radically different by using the same ways of thinking and brainstorming as we typically do. I want to bring in design thinking methodology into this. What do you think? He said, yeah, do it. And so I did. I ran a full-day session with the newly formed Change Council. I used design thinking methods and kind of framework in that session. And the big aha moment, in addition to having set what radical change meant and kind of the pillars of what we were going to focus on for the next year and a half, was at the dinner, I got a lot of people telling me, you made me so uncomfortable. Like, that was not what I was expecting. And I was like, I get that a lot. Yeah. But you tell me why. Like, what did I do in this instance to make you uncomfortable? And it was the methodology and the fact that I was stopping them from doing what they typically would have done, which was come in with a solution already. Right? Like they were expecting to come in to that day and say, this is what we should do. I've already got the idea. This is how we would do it. Our clients would love it for like these reasons. And we didn't do any of that. We spent a lot of time just really exploring a lot of different aspects and looking at it from a lot of different angles. And so not only did I make them feel uncomfortable, but then the follow-up was, and I really loved actually the way you made us think about things, right? Like that was really great. And that's when we had this moment of actually, if we could use design thinking as a way to actually shift how people in our law firm thought about problems and questions and interactions with clients, that in and of itself would be really, truly radical, right? Like that actual shift in culture and how our clients experience our service would be really freaking radical. So we made that one of the strategic programs of radical change. And that's actually how I met Treehouse Innovation, because it was kind of me at that moment. So we brought in Treehouse to help us create our own DLA design framework the training modules, because it was, we went radical, and it was every single person in DLA Piper should be trained up in design thinking for this mindset. Not because we wanted everyone to create products, but because we wanted people to have that aha moment of, ooh, God, I shouldn't have just come with a solution. There's another way. I need to be spending more time, being more exploratory, really trying to understand the goals of my clients and what a good experience for them might be. And then I can come in with my solution. So yeah, by the time I had left, it's still ongoing. Design thinking is still there. One of the best moments for me when I knew I could kind of say I'd done something was I was in a meeting that, and it was a head of operations of one of our legal practice teams. And they were doing a presentation that had nothing to do with my area. And they used the design thinking framework as the way to explain their new idea and how they were going to roll this project out. And I almost cried. Like, I literally almost started tearing up in this session. I was like, it's worked.
I've done something.
It worked. I've done something. Obviously not by myself. And obviously to have that space was very unique as a person doing innovation in legal. So DLA giving me that space was amazing. People at DLA being all about it. Over 2,500 people had taken the training voluntarily within 2 years. So it was awesome. And so for me, this is a very long-winded answer. For me, design thinking is a lot of things. I call the legal design for me is more around what you would say idiot-proofing contracts. It's not idiot-proofing. It's like maybe making contracts clearer or taking the idiocy out of a lot of the contracts. Like, let's actually just be clear about what we're doing. That to me is what I call legal design. Then design thinking can be used in two ways for me. One is to create those new products, services, and innovative solutions. And what I think is more profound is it just fundamentally can shift the way you as a lawyer, as a BD person, as anyone doing work really thinks about how you solve your clients' problems and how you deliver a better client experience.
Yeah. And it's one of those things you take a step back and you sort of, and I presume this was DLA International. It was everyone. It wasn't just the UK, because I don't know how many people there are in the UK in DLA. I wouldn't be surprised if it's more than 2,500, but you know, but you sort of, my brain goes through that process. And as you just described it, sort of whether you're a BD or a lawyer or this or that, but actually you're changing the fabric of how your organization thinks. You are starting to sort of make and change those elements. And I think, I guess there could have been some quick and easy wins through your ideation, right? Well, let's make sure that we sort of do something that somebody sits there and goes, yeah, actually they're doing something. But it wouldn't have had the same kind of impact. And I guess But you chose through, not luck, but through that initial session with those initial people, you sort of came upon a view that actually this can be the pillar of what we do and what we're focusing on. Were there other things, so as part of your initial sort of view of the world, you've talked about clients and the client experience. Like, was client experience part of that sort of, okay, we've got to improve the client experience. We've got to win the hearts and minds. We've got to do something else. What were the pillars that you focused in on initially?
Yeah, so the four initial pillars was client experience, data, AI. And now I'm forgetting the four.
We've gone 28 minutes. Well, no, I took 20-odd minutes without saying AI. Woo!
Yeah. And then, I forget, because then it quickly iterated, because then we realized data and AI are, you need both kind of to go together, right? You can't really, it's interesting that that's still something that a lot of people don't seem to understand. People still seem to think you can get an AI product without good data and it'll just solve all your problems. But that's another conversation. Data, AI, client experience, and just kind of, and consulting. Sorry, it was consulting. Okay. So design thinking, DLA design, was a program of work that came out of that initial session. So launched two products and a consulting service as well.
Okay, cool. Wow. That's what I mean. Yeah. You know, you as a moderately aged human, and I've worked
in. Am I moderately aged, or are you moderately aged?
I am I'm old. I'm old. Interestingly, on Wednesday night, I was out with some friends, and I aged a year in about a 5-minute conversation because I thought I was one age, but actually, I was a year older.
I've done that before.
I was slightly unnerved and upset, but anyway, it was fine. I got over it very quickly. I've just accepted my fate. But you work in jobs, and I guess I'm talking to sort of younger me and everything else. You go into a job, you go into a profession, and you want to make a difference. You don't just want to earn your money. You want to do something that you enjoy with people that you respect. And you actually want to walk out of it and go, I did something. My job was to do this, and I helped do it beyond just doing the 9-to-5 transactional. I did my job. And I guess that must be something that you got from that period of time. It sounds like you made sort of real impact on, which is awesome, with you and your team as such.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot that we got done. I think I don't normally take a lot of time reflecting back on what's been done. I'm usually way more focused on what's next.
Yeah.
But having been away for now a year and a half from DLA, I can look back and say, yeah, it was a great time. You know, we did do a lot of things, and the platform I was given and the latitude that was there in order to really push things in a lot of different directions was awesome. And you know, a lot of the products have launched. There's been a couple startups that have come out of it. DLA Design still persists. I still have, you know, amazing friends from DLA. Yeah, it was great. And you know, in another way, you know, professionally, it's given me the jumping board to do my own thing, right? Because I now have the credibility to say I actually did some stuff at a very large law firm with a lot of blue chip clients as well. So I can continue to do work.
It's a great thing. And I think you look at it as sort of, you know, most people, they go from sort of similar job in a similar industry to similar job in a similar industry, if not the same industry. And ultimately that's typically benefiting the organization that you're in. But when you take a step out, and as you've done, you're now consulting to law firms and in-house teams, your experience is now benefiting multiple organizations. And I think that's one of the things that you can, when you get that little nod and that confidence of, yeah, I did some shit and it was really cool, and that gives you the confidence to then go and do something else to benefit the wider industry. Because let's be honest, legal, and I say oftentimes, I mean, I've been in legal for 25 years, or maybe more, maybe a little bit less, maybe more. But you go through this thing, and it still feels like we're treading in a bit of sand, it's slow. There is a lot of opportunity for better, brighter things that isn't just Gen AI related, and we'll come back to that. But I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity, whether it be what we do, process re-engineering and sort of thinking about, okay, well, how do you digitize things and make things a little bit more efficient, and sort of those incremental changes through to, as you talked about before, capability creation. Tell me what you mean by, I think I know, but tell me what you mean by capability creation in the context of our conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to pick up on what you said, I think there's so much opportunity, right? And I have meetups regularly with people of, I guess, our tenure in legal innovation. And some of those meetups are, let's whine over wine about, you know, all the missed opportunities, if I can say it that way. But then recently I've been bringing a small group of people together to think about, okay, we know that a lot of change hasn't happened as fast as or in the way that we all would have liked or could see or were advocating for very hard. But where are those real opportunities for change in the industry? Because I absolutely agree that there's so much change. And if you think about it positively, there's a lot of opportunity for a lot of great things to happen in this space.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, 100%.
And so, and I think, you know, if I look back at when I started in legal innovation 10-ish years ago, it has shifted in that more people are understanding that they do need to do some things differently, and some firms are doing things differently already. And then there's a lot still where they've identified, we would like to innovate, we'll just keep using that word, or we want to transform, or maybe we actually want to understand our data. And you're going to need to create that capability, right? That's what I mean. Once you've identified in your strategy, gosh, we'll just use the data example. We really want to leverage AI, but actually in order to leverage AI, we really need to be feeding it the right data. In order to do that, we got to figure out where our data lives and how we can access it and everything else. Usually you don't just have people that can do that very well sitting around and doing commercial law or doing BD or whatever else exists in that law firm, right? And so capability creation would be once you've identified that there's an area or a service or a new offering you want to be creating, you need to get in the right people, you need to get in the right processes, you need to get in the right structure in order to make that happen, and even the right tech, if that's right, depending on what that capability is. So I love that space. I love taking a quite ambiguous or open-ended, this is what we want to achieve, and then figuring out, okay, well, how does that work? What would be the best way in order to make that happen in this firm or for this in-house team?
I think that just becomes, it's one of those things that you sort of take a step back, and I've sat in meetings, hundreds of meetings, where you go, and I've probably been guilty for the most part of being this kind of person, but you sit there and you're either doing one of two things. You've said something that's quite different, but very off the cuff. Oh, yeah, we'll do this. And there's no real consideration to how or why, other than the fact that somebody said it in a meeting and they thought it was a good idea, and they have enough influence to make the thing happen.
Right.
But then the other side to that is sort of you very quickly, particularly the person who had the idea, and as you said before, is already a solution in their brain. There's already a budget line to sort of go, well, it's going to cost us this much type thing. So stripping all of that away and then sort of going back to the design thinking principles and everything else, I think that's sort of capability creation is one of those things that you sort of, it is brand new. It's like, and you're right, there isn't necessarily a data architect sat in your organization unless you've recruited a data architect that isn't doing any data. But I think it's how do you market that in the sense of, and I guess you market that through your reputation and through what you do and everything else. I'm thinking not many people think like they sort of go, oh, we need a budget and a project line and a this and that. How do you break those barriers? How do you go through the practical process of thinking about it or instilling that small amount of change in an environment where you're just a consultant, you've just been drafted in to do some workshops and some information, or what do you leave behind?
Yeah. Oh, that's a lot of questions, Ben.
Sorry.
Okay. Let's try to go through them one by one. So I think if I'll start with, I don't know that you said this specifically, but if I read between the lines and just say it more bluntly, how would I sell capability creation to organizations that typically just say, here's the idea, let's just make it happen without real thought as to all the things that need to take place and people that need to be brought in order to make that thing happen, right?
That's the question I should have asked in a very, very concise way, but I didn't.
All right. Well, let me try to answer the question now that I've just asked myself. You're right. I'm not probably going to be the person that mass markets, right? Because, I'm okay with that. Obviously, I want clients, but I enjoy doing things the right way, and I enjoy doing things in a way that will give you the best results, right? And so if I'm talking to a client and they're saying, we want to just do this, and I hate when people say just, like, let's just do that, right? The thing that I would start with is then start to articulate, well, that's great. You should definitely just do that. But in order to do that, kind of start to explain high level all the various considerations, right? And what needs to be thought of, and then hopefully sell them on the fact that I could deliver all those things you need to consider. So to take a step back at DLA, yeah, the data capability was something that I created, right? From nothing. And then two Imperial data students, data scientists, to then actually creating AI products at the end. So I've done it before, and I personally had to go through all of the hurdles and convincing a business of what actually needed to be in place to make these things happen. So it's lived experience, right? So I actually would not want to work with a client if they thought it was just a line item on a budget and just a project that could be done in 6 months without fully, if we're going to do this and we're going to do it well, we need to be considering everything else. And that's who I would want to work with. So perhaps I'm limiting myself. I hope not. But I think that the market is maturing enough to know that if it was easy, it would be done already and it would be done by everybody, right? But you can't just bring in a piece of legal tech and everything's sorted.
I can completely agree. And on that point, we spend a lot of time talking about how we, as Autologix, we want to partner with our customers rather than... It's really easy to be too transactional about everything. It's just, oh, it's a done, it's a contract, it's a this, it's a that, it's just, you know. And I really like the way that you hate the word just or in that context, because it's always triggered me, but I've never really realized why until you explain, not explaining it, because I'm not that stupid, but, you know, in that context, it's the idea of that it's a throwaway thing. It's quick and easy. And it's sort of, you think about these things. And I think oftentimes you hear that from people who have deep domain expertise, and they say, well, I've been doing this for 20 years. It's just. And actually, it's like, well, yeah, but if you wanted to digitize something or re-architect a process, it isn't just, because you've got to think about the stakeholders and who does what at what point and all this. And then you start to really dig into it. And I think, because of what we do, we spend a lot of time talking. We'd love hundreds of more customers. You know, we're a company rather than an individual consultant. So, but we are being really careful at the moment about the types of clients and the types of projects we're working on with our customers, because we want to make sure that what we're doing isn't sort of a fad or a throwaway thing. It's actually making real change. And we spend a lot of time sort of, and we sort of walk away from some projects and sort of say, actually, it's not quite right for us for a bunch of different reasons. And I think we don't necessarily even have the luxury to do that. But, you know, if your product isn't right, because we're a product organization, you sort of sit there and you have to be honest with yourself around their intentions and where we are and what we can actually achieve. But I think you didn't say that you're worried, but sort of you're narrowing down your potential, sort of your market, really. But actually, you find that sort of sweet spot, and it will just, you know, that's where you get the most sort of reward and most outcomes and the most success, I guess, in that scenario. So that is the right way to think about it.
Thank you. Thanks for validating.
There we go. In terms of thinking about, so capability creation on an internal side of things, when you, and I know this is an extension thereof, but when you were thinking about sort of service lines, products and things like that, where do you see the opportunities within legal to not just do law, for example? You know, where, because I know that legal entities can only do certain things, and then you have to create sort of separate business entities to do other things, and there's a whole sort of stuff that I don't always understand, but, you know, I say the words in the right order sometimes. Where do you see those kinds of opportunities for law firms to go, and how close does that take them to the more traditional consulting firms who have got the tax and the this and the that kind of things?
Yeah, good question. There's a lot of opportunities. If we go, so this is something it's very prescient and pressing on my mind at the moment. is, especially as of this week, right, looking at all the various AI that people are using and the people that own those various companies and technologies. Yep. And if I take a step back, even 8 years ago when I was trying to convince people to use Kira, one of the questions that all the lawyer, that I, not all the lawyers, one of the questions I would get quite frequently would be, well, there'd be two. One would be, should I learn to code? Do all lawyers need to learn to code? And will AI take our jobs? And the first one, I said, no. I mean, if you want to, please, by all means, learn to code. It's not going to hurt you. But I'm not telling everyone to learn to code. You need to understand how code is created and what makes good code and shit code and how you can use code. But I don't need all the lawyers to be coding. And it might take the tasks that you're doing now, but it opens up a lot of opportunities for new roles. And that brings me to answer your question, and which is, I feel very strongly that lawyers should be taking a very strong role in guiding or highlighting ethical use of AI and highlighting when there are some very strong negative moral implications from what's being created and rolled out in the world at the moment. So I would love if more lawyers, instead of thinking about, will AI take my job, thinking about how can I use my training as a lawyer who knows about justice, who's been taught to uphold the justice system and think about fairness and equity and people's rights and civil liberties. How can I take those skills and think about what's going on in the world and apply them in a different way? It's a different role. So I would love if more lawyers and law firms did that and could consult on that, because lawyers still are, for the most part, trusted, right? And we're used in a lot of situations to be that compass, an ethical compass for companies or for individuals. This is right. This is wrong. This could lead you in this way. Gosh, if we could be in more of those conversations early on before we're dealing with the repercussions of what's just unleashed, that would be amazing. Yeah, I feel very strongly about that. What else? On a lighter note, I think, is it lighter? And I think there's a lot of this is strange. Weird, I don't know why, but maybe it's just because of who lawyers are innately or the types of people who become lawyers, or I don't know what it is, but you always feel like it's this competition for a very, very small amount, right? Like we're all like, ooh, there's not enough. There's a scarcity mindset within legal. But then if you actually look at the facts and numbers of like what the largest law firm has, what, less than 1% of the entire legal market that's possible? Like, there's so much opportunity.
Yeah.
There's so much opportunity. We just take a step back and maybe we just don't fight over that 1% anymore. Like, let's think about that huge market that still exists that is unserved, right? It's not the typical market that we're used to. It's not that, and then really think about, and you can call that access to justice, and it is access to justice. So it's very important, but that doesn't mean it's not profitable or there's no money there. Right. And it's just a different way of looking at how you make that, how you can make a good business out of serving a lot of different companies, people that are just not getting their needs met by the current law firms or legal systems or legal organizations, whatever you want to call them, that are in existence at the moment. So what does that look like? Oh, I don't know. Would I love to start to create some of that with people? Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. There's a lot of opportunity there.
Yeah. No, and I think and you just touched on some really interesting stuff. And you see you coming through in that. It's absolutely genuine, and that's absolutely sort of focused. And I think that sort of you're right. There's been a rise and an increase in the focus of access to justice across the industry, but it's sort of, and this is going to sound terrible, and it's not as prevalent here in the UK, but maybe in the US in terms of perception. But you know, you sort of you hear access to justice used a lot in the US in our world, less so here, perhaps. And I don't know all the background, so I don't understand why. But, you know, you start to think about, okay, well, where are the opportunities? What can you do? And how can sort of the big players make a difference, as opposed to just saying they're making a difference, if that makes sense? And I'm thinking technology other than sort of the law firms themselves, because I've not sort of been on that side recently. But, you know, you think about what the opportunity is, and it is massive. You make a big difference. Yeah, definitely.
We should talk about it later, or we can talk about it now and then talk about it more later. I went to, you're right, it wasn't called Access to Justice. That's my American coming through. But the Civil Justice Council had a conference last month, and I started to talk to some people, and I was the innovator in a lot of of the conversations, which a lot of people assumed I did tech, or I was a startup with tech. And so they were voicing a lot of their frustrations about how the legal tech startups didn't address a lot of their needs, which I said, okay, but, you know, we should think about what those needs are, and they're not going to know what they are just on their own. But okay, let me speed this up. I think, you know, the big tech players have a huge opportunity there, because on the other hand of that is, why do the pro bono or people providing just access to justice to a lot of individuals around the UK need to be relying on startups to create it, when actually there's a lot of great solutions that already exist that could do a lot of good in supercharging those organizations? So there's something definitely there. We can talk about this off the podcast, but
yes, we definitely should. We definitely should. So you talked, and we'll probably run another 10 or so minutes thinking about sort of timing and everything else. So you've talked today about sort of the role of, you need good data to get good stuff out of AI. Obviously, in the last sort of 2 and a bit years, generative AI has popped up, and it's all everyone's talking about.
Of course.
Everything and everywhere. If it isn't GPT this, it's DeepSeek that, and if it isn't that, it's this and everything else. And I think that I can say from our, what's really interesting is that probably 2 years ago, people would come to us and go, oh, so process, what's the role of data in process? And I said, well, data is fundamentally important to scaling process. You need to understand what your data is to do that. And they'd go, oh, yeah, data. They'd sort of do that. And I think the one thing that all of the noise around generative AI and AI in general, but generative specifically, has been people suddenly realizing that, shit, we've got to have good data, or we've got to have access to our good data, or know what good looks like. And that's been sort of transformative to us, not generative AI itself, but the understanding that you need that good kind of clean understanding of your data to then drive and scale what we do. I know it's a loaded question. The whole generative AI thing and the pace of change. I was chatting to somebody earlier on this week. How do you attempt to keep up with everything? Because there's so much. I can't keep up. I can't keep up with it all. My little brain doesn't cope very well with the pace of change, the technical needs to be able to understand the change and all of that sort of stuff. How do you process all of that?
Yeah. Well, I'm supposed to say, yes, I keep up with it. I'm ahead of it all, Ben. I know all of it. I'm an expert. it's a lot. I try to read as much as I can. There's people on Facebook. Not Facebook. We're trying to get away from Meta. There's people on LinkedIn that I follow and read, and then we'll read articles. It was interesting. I had a conversation recently with someone at one of the many firms that's brought in Harvey. I'm always interested to hear what the lived experience of people using these great solutions are. And I think Harvey is a great solution, and it can be really powerful. But in this situation, that firm had decided to not actually allow Harvey access to any of its own data. And I was thinking, then what? So how is it going to create that great first draft of a template that you can use when it's not accessing your good? Right. To your point, Ben, it's, I mean, everyone says this, everyone says shit in, shit out, right? Right. So, okay, then where's your good? Like, let's teach it the good so that it can bring back good responses. And actually, determining what good is and then finding out where the good exists is actually quite complicated and a process for most law firms, not even law firms, organizations.
Businesses. Okay. Yeah, 100%.
And it's just so interesting because now people, I don't even know if everyone still gets that, right? I think that's what's been really interesting to me is that I was saying this 8 years ago and we're still saying it now, right? The tech is powerful. The tech can do a lot. The tech can learn. The tech can bring back. The tech can summarize. It can do all these things, but you got to feed it. You got to tell it what good is. You got to tell it what you want it to summarize. You got to tell it that summarization was wrong or right. You got to help it in some way. And people would kind of just look at me and be like, but like, so this isn't real AI then? And I'm like, well, no, it's AI, but it's just literally how it works, right? Especially if you want it to work for your business within your risk tolerances, with your contracts, to then create the next version, you need to feed it what you want. So it's keeping up, and that's hard on like on the global scale of like what's going on. On maybe this is me sounding really too cynical.
I think your point about it's not just law firms, it's businesses, it's organizations. I think that what makes it really interesting is that because of the nature of the end product of 90%, 95% of a law firm's sort of stuff they do for clients, is words in documents, which is really hard because you sort of take a step back and you go, right, well, we've done 1,000 of these this month, but actually only 4 of them or 100 of them or whatever are what we would consider clean and good. And then there's variation, but we can't give it all because if we give it everything, then everything's going to, and you sort of, I think it comes back to something that Alex Smith always says and everyone else, but it's the hard yards. Doing good data practice and feeding a tool like Harvey or whatever is it's all about the data, and it's really hard to get right. And it's sort of, there isn't a silver bullet, really. There might be in the future. There might be in the future, but there isn't a silver bullet now. And I think that's the thing. I think everyone goes, oh, AI is going to save me time. It's going to be amazing. But I don't need to do anything else. I just need to buy some AI and it's all going to be fine. Right. And it's like, okay, do you really understand? Yeah. And I don't. I genuinely don't understand everything, or well, most things, quite frankly. But, you know, you take that step back through and you go, shit in, shit out. You do have to think about what goes through and how that sort of affects everything, really. A final question to sort of take a step back. Where, and this is a bit sort of out there, where do you see all of this going in the sense of you've talked about sort of 8 years ago, the vision of like getting good understanding of your data, moving that forward, and the fact that you're still having these kind of conversations, which is you need to fix this to enable you to get to, it's not like you can go to Marylebone Road and then skip past go and get $200 or £200 or whatever. You've got to do the steps. You've got to go through the hard yards of everything. But where do you see it all going, as in, sort of the idea of innovation and AI being the dominant sort of the dominant view of everything, which underplays the importance of the change and the focus on the change?
Where do I see it all going? Okay. That's a big one. I can go a lot of different ways, can't it?
What would you like to see? Okay, ignore the random question. What would you like to see happen?
What would I like to see happen? I would like to see happen. You know, I think if you think about why a lot of people went to law school, right? And then you reflect on what their day-to-day work and lives look like, there's probably a big discrepancy or, you know, between what they envisioned they would be doing, the type of good, I don't want to say that, a lot of lawyers do a lot of good work, but the type of stuff that they have to do is probably not at all what they envisioned. I would love if a lot of law firms thought about how to create the capabilities to get their data in a great place to act, to leverage all the great capabilities that exist in the world right now with AI, not just as a cost savings exercise, but also as a way to think about how we actually have like a happier profession. There's not that many happy lawyers, unfortunately. We rank really high in a lot of bad rankings, like substance abuse and depression and burnout, right? How do we actually think about things? And again, this kind of goes back to what I was saying before. And I was talking about it more in a macro ethical world situation of lawyers being that voice of what should be happening. And I think we should be thinking about how should we be leveraging these AI capabilities to not only make more money, but actually improve our lives, right? Make better. Make it, that could look like a lot of different things, like allow our lawyers to focus on the things that really matter, that aren't so mind-numbingly awful to get through. Empower them to do some of that shift of, if we bring it back to the beginning of design thinking, of being able to really explore with their clients, what are those unmet needs? What could that look like? How could I enhance this experience and this relationship in different ways and give them that space, right? That space to do that type of work. Because a lot of lawyers are really highly intelligent people, and most lawyers really care about their clients and want to be giving them a great advice, great service. Unfortunately, the lived experience of a lot of lawyers is getting through a lot of shit every day because they have to get on to the next. Yeah. And now people are talking about AI like, oh, it's going to take their jobs, and they're looking at it in a very like threatening way. And it could be, it could definitely be that. But actually the other way of thinking about it, and what I hope happens, is we think about it, well, let's think about it more holistically, not just replacing people, but having happier people. What might that look like?
That would be nice. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Because AI for good. You know, you take a step back and you sort of go, okay, well, yeah, there is an opportunity to make more money, to be more efficient, to do this. But actually, if you can create a happier, more sort of, well, just a happier workforce, that's where you sort of are. That's a good ambition to have for the industry. I like that. It's a good way to wrap up. I've really loved this conversation. Thank you very much for taking the time out on a Friday afternoon and chatting with me. I'm not even going to say anymore. I'm just going to say thanks and have a glorious weekend.